So thank you very much for this quick and interesting introduction around. So as facilitator, I'm now happy that I may introduce Nicole Rummel also. So maybe to my to the introduction of myself, I'm doing research about collaboration script for computer supported learning. So maybe you might see the connection that the first contact I got to Nicole Rummel was by reading her excellent articles about collaboration scripts, where she did, for example, comparisons between scripts and modeling as two different ways to support collaboration skills. So now I'm proud that I may introduce Nicole Rummel to you in the context of this Naples webinar. So Nicole is mainly, as we have seen, a professor for educational psychology here in Germany at the Ruhr University in Bochum. And she's also additionally an adjunct professor at the HCI Institute at Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh. So furthermore, she is a member of important national and international societies that are in our field and holds positions there, like in the ISLS or in the early. As far as I know, her research includes supporting collaborative learning, proactive failure, instructions for math learning, and much more. But now it would be great to hear more from Nicole herself. So I think you also, we are all curious about the webinar today about example-based learning. And Nicole, it would be great if you could say in the beginning a couple of words about yourself also and your journey to the learning sciences. That means how you experience the way of your own research from studying psychology in the beginning to doing research in the learning sciences today. So the floor is open. Welcome, Nicole, and I'm looking forward to the webinar now.
Thanks, Fridays, for the very nice introduction, and thanks everybody for being here. And I hope that we can touch some of the questions that you guys came with. I, of course, have some basic introductions about the topic of example-based learning, but I hope that in the end we will also have a lot of time for further discussions where you can bring in your questions, which I already was listening to sounded very interesting. So what brought me to the learning sciences, coming from psychology, and maybe also starting out with what brought me to example-based learning, like why am I talking about this topic here today? So two things. I started after I finished high school, I started as a teacher's college. So I wanted to become a teacher, but then soon noticed that, yes, I did like teaching, but much more did I like to think about learning and learn about learning and do research in learning. So I switched to psychology and wanted to learn how students think, how they learn, how they memorize things. I then went from Germany to the U.S. on a Fulbright scholarship to Madison, Wisconsin, and did a master's there, where I worked with Sharon Derry and Joe Levin, also on how students memorize things, how they learn things. And that's also where I first got in contact with the CSCL, the computer-supported collaborative learning community, working with Sharon Derry there. So my interest in learning about how students learn and studying how students learn moved into the direction of particularly looking at collaborative learning. And here I then became very interested in comparing, like Fridays already mentioned, comparing how students learn with scripts, if we tell them in a sort of specific manner, step-by-step manner, how they should collaborate, which steps they should perform. If we compare this to what I believe and what you see a lot in the literature is a very powerful capacity in human beings, which is observational learning or model learning. So this is what brought me to this topic of learning by examples, coming from the area of collaborative learning and wondering how can we help students, particularly in quite complex collaborative situations, to collaborate well. What are ways of providing them training and instruction? And it turned out actually at that point quite to my surprise that showing them a complex model, a modeling example of this collaboration was very powerful, and I will come back to this later in my talk. So then maybe the second thing that brought me to the learning sciences, and here I'm talking more about what brought me to the Society of the Learning Sciences, which this Naples webinar is part of, is that doing research in CSCL, I was giving talks at CSCL conferences, and then at some point, as some of you may know, which was in 2003, there was an initiative to join forces with the ISLS, with the International Society of the Learning Sciences. And then I started to also attend those conferences, the International Conference of the Learning Sciences, which this year, as many of you may know, is going to take place in Boulder, Colorado. And so I also broadened my interest and got to talk to people who are doing research on learning and also particularly on example-based learning, not only in the area of collaboration. And then very specifically, and this is leading over, I guess, Fridis, if I may, otherwise please interrupt me, to the topic of today. Then I got to discuss with people like Alexander Rankel, but also with Tamara von Gogh, who were interested in example-based learning coming from very different perspectives. And we had a lot of conversations, which ended up by both of us, Tamara and I, but also Alexander Rankel, publishing review articles on bringing together different views on example-based learning from worked example research, but also from social cognitive research. And this is kind of where I come from, how I come to the learning sciences, how I came to this topic today. And unless Fridis, would you like me to start moving into the presentation then? Or is there something supposed to be in between? Yes, okay. You would like me to move into the presentation. Okay, so if you could just go to the type from the title slide, which is slide number 2. The first thing that I would like to do is to ask you to go to a link that Fridis will post in the chat, which is a link to a Google Doc. And I would like you to spend 5 minutes to write down in the Google Doc all kinds of different situations and examples that you can come up with where you are learning from examples, from observing, from looking at models, from your own experiences, but also maybe from your research, sort of to see what is the variety of where people learn by example. So I'm going to stop broadcasting now and give you 5 minutes, and we'll meet back here in the flash meeting at 5:25. You can also use the chat, by the way, if you want to exchange or if you want to exchange some things other than examples. If you want to discuss, you can use the chat for now. Otherwise, just go to the file and start typing in whatever examples come to your mind. Okay, you guys are typing a lot, and I think we have a lot of examples now. I would like to leave it at that for now. We're not looking, you've probably watched, like I was doing, the variety of things that were being typed in the Google Doc, and we will come back to those examples later in the game today. And please don't be irritated if I look a little bit to the side. I have my slides on another screen next to me. So, coming back to the presentation, I'd like you to move to the next slide, slide number 4. And here, what you can see is what will be the basic structure of my talk today. And as you've seen, that's also the basic structure of the paper that some of you may have read in preparation for the meeting. If you look at the research that has been done on learning from examples, more broadly speaking, you can distinguish two lines of research. The one line of research has looked at observational learning, in other words, learning by observing a model's behavior of performing a task. And this research has been done in the tradition of the sociocognitive theory. So the main person, the main name to mention here would be Albert Bandura and his seminal work on observational and model learning. And the other research paradigm is learning from studying worked examples, which is has been researched mostly in the area of cognitive load theory. That's where also the term worked examples, learning with worked examples came from, and the name to mention here, among many others, and some of them will come up later in the game, is of course John Sweller and his work on cognitive load theory. And those two perspectives, as we will see as I continue through my talk, do have a lot of things in common. And in particular, what they share is the idea that by studying observing exemplary performance of different kinds, we are able to construct cognitive representations that will allow us, that will enable us to show behavior later, to show the same or similar behavior in the same or similar situations. But there's also one fundamental difference between the two, and I hope this difference will become clearer as I go along. I would like to mention it first time here. It's the nature of the attentional processes here, where for worked examples, it is fairly clear what to pay attention to because of the way they're designed, which makes it very clear for what students are expected to look at and what they are expected to learn. What they do, worked example, is they show how a problem should be solved or how a task should be performed as compared to observational learning where the modeling shows more how a particular task would be solved or has perhaps been solved by a person. It can also be didactically designed, but it is definitely more of the how it would or was solved, was done, rather than how it should be done for the worked examples. Let's move to the next slide. And please, if you have questions, it's always fine to interrupt me and to just raise your arm and ask questions. Otherwise, I'll just continue. So next is slide 5. Looking a little closer into those two paradigms and how what the principles are that are underlying the research, and looking at examples also from this research, I would like first of all like to move to the observational learning paradigm, where, as I already mentioned, the idea is that the learner observes a model performing a task or showing a certain activity, and the model shows how the problem is solved, in fact, not how it should be solved, but how it is solved. And it can, the model can still behave didactically. That's particularly true when you come to modeling cognitive tasks or to modeling things that would normally not be made explicit. So if a model models something where an expert model would normally, for instance, skip particular steps, here, in a didactic behaving model, the model would not skip the steps. It would show all things that are necessary to perform the task well. The presentation of modeling examples can take very different forms. It can be presented face-to-face, so the observer can sit next to the model or stand next to the model and observe the model. But it can also be recorded in a certain way, replayed later. One very distinctive feature and also one danger when studying observational learning from modeling examples is that the information here is transient information. So it is information that you can look at, you can watch the model, but once the moment is over, the moment is over. So it's nothing, you can of course watch it over again, but it's nothing that you can sort of study very closely as you are looking at the model. Let's move to one example of one typical research example, one of the most well-known studies from Bandura. So please move to slide 6. This is the so-called Rocky or Bobo doll experiment that Bandura conducted in 1965, or published, I should say, in 1965. And it illustrates what is very typical for a lot of work in this area. So here in the first phase, children in the kindergarten age watched an adult model. Sometimes it was a male model. In this particular study, it was a male model. Sometimes it was also a female model. And his or her behavior towards a Bobo doll, it's kind of a, you'll see a picture in one of the next slides, kind of a clown doll that can stand up again when you push it down. And this model would show aggressive behaviors towards the Bobo doll, towards this doll. Those behaviors were novel behaviors, and this is important for sort of the experimental logic of how Bandura performed these experiments or conducted these experiments. The aggressive behaviors had to be novel in order to be sure that if children would show those behaviors later after having observed the model, that this couldn't be a coincidence simply because they show them anyways. Therefore, he was very, he tried to make sure and was very careful to use behaviors, model behaviors, that were very different from the kinds of behaviors that the children would normally show in their regular play. Next slide, slide number 7. Then there were actually 3 different versions of what happened after the model had treated in an aggressive manner this Bobo doll. In one version, in condition 1, the model received rewards. So a second person came in, a second adult came in, patted him on his shoulder and said, hey, you did well. This doll really needed some treatment. I mean, he was not behaving well all the time, so I'm glad you finally gave him this punishment. In the second condition, the presentation of the model ended with a second person coming in and punishing the model for his aggressive behavior, telling him off and telling him, if you do this again, it will have very negative consequences. This is not a way how you can treat a doll or any person. You should be ashamed of yourself. You shouldn't behave that way. So it was a condition where the model was threatened and punished after having been aggressive. And in a third condition, nothing happened. The movie or the presentation of the model simply ended with the aggressive behaviors that the model had shown. Then there were two test phases. In the first test phase, children were brought into the same room and they just were asked, had some time to play in the room. So they were the same objects. The doll was there and other objects were there that the model had used to show his aggressive behavior towards the doll. And it was recorded what they did. So in other words, it was recorded, it was looked at what the spontaneous imitation behavior of the children would be depending upon the consequences they had seen for the model. In the second test phase, the experimenter came in and told the children, oh, you just watched this movie where the guy hit the doll. Can you please, is there anything you can remember? If you remember anything, could you please go ahead and show me what you remember? You're going to get chocolate, or sometimes it was stickers or something that the children liked, some reward that they got for every single model behavior that they could imitate. The next slide shows a screenshot or shows pictures from this experiment. So in the first row, you see 3 eating, showing the behaviors, the aggressive behaviors towards the Bobo doll. In this case, it was a female, but as I said, in the 65 experiment, it was in fact a male. And then in the two bottom rows, you can see children, boy and a girl, working, playing in the same room, and as you can already see, they're showing very similar behaviors. Let's move to the next slide. What did we see? What did they see? What did Bandura observe in the two test phases? In the first test phase, where he was looking at the spontaneous imitation behavior of these children, what they found is that in the condition where the model had been punished, the children showed less imitation behavior. In the condition where the model had been rewarded, there was more imitation behavior. Well, for you, that may not be surprising, but at the time where it was believed, and it was sort of the area, the end area of behaviorism, it was believed that you could only learn by doing things yourself and by experiencing the consequences of those behaviors yourself. So to those people at that point in time, it was quite some news that it would indeed be enough to see the consequences for another person, and you could equally learn from those. So observing consequences for others here had an effect. In test phase two, in the reinforced condition where the imitation, the modeling behavior was reinforced, the differences between the conditions disappeared. So all children in all three conditions showed were able to remember and show the same amount of behavior that they had seen the model perform. In other words, and this was again at the time, this was a sort of groundbreaking result, this shows that the children learned from seeing the model, point one. So they learned the aggressive behaviors that the model had shown from observing the model. And they did that even though they didn't imitate them right away, and even though they had seen different consequences to the model. There would have been the expectation that if you see a model being punished, that you don't learn from it, that you learn that it's not a good idea and you don't even learn from it. But what they found here is that they indeed learned from it. They saw it, they learned that the consequences may be bad. So in the first test phase, they didn't spontaneously imitate the behavior, but that didn't mean that they hadn't learned it. They had learned it and they could remember it. So it was more a matter of motivation in the first test phase, and in the second test phase, that was then reinforced so that the children would show the behavior. If you go to the next slide, you can see the learning processes that Bandura tried to study with this and many, many other experiments, and this is also what is typical for this kind of research in this one paradigm. You will see that the goals in the worked example research have been different, but in the observational learning research, particularly Bandura, but also others, have mostly been interested in trying to find out what does it take and how do students learn from watching models. And it was at that time really groundbreaking by Bandura to point out that not only did students have to attend to the model, that's quite obvious, but that they had to be memorizing, that there had to be retention processes, that there had to be a storing of what had been observed in memory. So it wasn't something automatic, but it was something where students had to deduct principles from the observed behavior and memorize in an abstract manner those principles. And that's one of the main goals of what you do when you observe a model. You're supposed to pay attention to what is important, and that's also one of the main challenges, because you need to be able to distinguish what is important and what is not. And then the second important thing is that you need to be able to remember what has been important. You need strategies for memorizing, for abstracting the underlying principles and memorizing those. here are the points three and four, and that was, like I already said, very important at the time. Three is reproduction. So in order to learn a model behavior, it's not only that you have to attend to it and that you have to remember it, that you have to sort of build a mental representation, but also there needs to be a possibility for you to practice, whether mentally, like in your head, whether cognitively rehearsing, or whether actually showing the behavior and then adapting slowly from what you have seen to what you're doing by getting feedback from your environment, for instance. And then the fourth point points to what the second test phase in the Bandura experiment had shown, that the motivation processes are really important with regard to whether an observed behavior in the end is going to be shown. Because if you're have observed it, if you've learned it, but if you've also learned that it's probably not a good idea to show it, then you might not be motivated or you might just not show it. Whereas if you were like in the test phase to the children, if you're then being rewarded or you're being told that you would be rewarded, you're going to be motivated to show it. So this studying what it takes and what are the involved processes was really the focus of this work and a lot of work of Bandura. Here on the next slide, so you will see another research example. That's a research example that Freitas had already mentioned and I had already mentioned as well. It's from our own research. And in this research, what students did here was that they observed recorded scenes of a collaboration, of a successful collaboration. And it was actually a quite complicated situation. It was a psychologist and a medical doctor collaborating on a difficult patient case where the diagnosis was really difficult because it wasn't clear which of the symptoms that the patient would show were psychological symptoms and which were medical symptoms and which were maybe side effects of the medication that the person received. For instance, in one of the cases, the patient suffered from multiple sclerosis and was, of course, heavily medicated, but then also showed symptoms of a depression. And the question was, well, to what extent are those an effect of, side effect of the medication, perhaps also an effect of the multiple sclerosis, or to what extent is it a separate diagnosis that needs to be made here? And the two people were, moreover, collaborating remotely. They were collaborating over a video conference. Right now, that's not very surprising anymore because everybody can use Skype. But at the time when we did the study, which was in the early 2000s, it was quite difficult to have a video conference. The idea was that this would be a setting that could occur and when, for instance, a patient comes to a doctor and the doctor is wondering if he or she is able to diagnose the patient by him or herself and therefore wants to get in touch with a colleague from the other discipline. Here, the presentation of the model was in a multimedia presentation with Macromedia Flash. Presented on the computer screens, and we had audio recordings of dialogue between the two collaborators. If you move to the next slide, you can actually see a screenshot. And on the screenshot, you can see that there were images of the two collaborators, so there wasn't actually video in the model, but there were just symbolic images. Then there was audio. They were talking to each other, and then there was also a shared text window, which the two collaborators used to write down their notes from their discussion on what would be the best diagnosis for the case here. Next slide. So what we found out in this research was that observing this model, and as you may have gotten the notion, this was quite a complex model. It was actually a two-hour model that they watched only once. And then in the next step, they were asked to collaborate on a similar case, a case that had different symptoms, different diseases, so nothing of the content from the first case could be transferred, but the structure of the second case was similar. So the students were, after watching this model once, were asked to work on a similar case over the video conference together and come up with a diagnosis, and this, their performance was compared to a condition in which the first been scripted in their collaboration. So where the first case had been done, had been solved in a scripted collaboration manner, and to another control condition where the students had solved the first case in an unsupported collaboration. We further had conditions where we prompted self-explanation activities, both for the scripting but also for the model. And what we found is that the observing a model led to better collaboration, so the students collaborated better if you analyze their collaboration processes, but also a better joint solution. So the diagnosis that they came up with was better after observing the model as compared to after working on case one in a scripted manner, as compared to working on case one in an unsupported collaborative manner. Any questions until this point or about the examples from observational learning? If not, then let's move to the next slide, slide 14. What I've listed on this slide are some of the main characteristics or design principles that can be deducted from the literature that have been researched and where we can make some conclusions for what we should take into account when we design such modeling examples. One thing that has been researched a lot is model observer similarity. The aspects that have been researched here are gender, age, competence, background, and it has been found that generally, although it's not always clear, but generally it's a better idea if there is a similarity between the model and the observer. And it has been pointed out by researchers, some researchers like, for instance, Shank, that it may be a matter of self-efficacy that is that a person perceives as they're watching the model. In other words, if a model is similar to me in some of the characteristics, like for instance gender or age, it may be that I consider my chances to perform like the model does and do it successfully more likely as if it's very dissimilar. For instance, if a first grade student a kid of like 6 years looks at a baseball player performing certain moves on a baseball field. He may conclude that it's not likely that he will be able to show the same moves simply because of the physical differences between him as a six-year-old boy and the baseball player. And therefore, while he may be a big fan of the baseball player, he may not think that his chances of behaving that way, of modeling, of imitating that behavior are very likely. Sort of a sub-aspect of this is the second point here, mastery modeling versus coping model. There has also been a lot of research on whether what the model shows should be characterized by a lot of expertise. In other words, whether the model should show a flawless performance, should show exactly how it would be solved in an ideal way, a certain problem, or whether it should rather maybe show how it's struggling and then how it's overcoming its problems. And it has also similar to the, it has to do also with the self-efficacy point, that it's more likely that a model is going to be imitated and is going to receive a lot of attention if it's a coping model. Mastery modeling works particularly well if the observers already have quite a bit of prior knowledge, because if a model performs very flawless and if it has a lot of expertise, then it's less likely that an inexperienced learner at the beginning of its learning process will be able to follow what's going on and would have any indication that he or she would be able to imitate this behavior. The next principles that are listed here are in fact principles that come from multimedia research, and where it has become obvious that listening to example presentations like we do in modeling examples, it is a better idea if the model talks about in a personalized manner rather than saying one should do this and that. The model should say, I'm thinking that we should take into account this symptom of or I think I should do this now. So in a personalist rather than in a neutral manner. And the voice principle points to the fact that social presence is perceived as higher, and there's also more motivation resulting from that if it's a natural voice rather than a recorded voice. So you should indeed try to, in other words, you could say, design the environment, record what is being said, the dialogue, for instance, in as natural as possible manner. So designing it in an artificial environment is not working out too well. The image principle points at the maybe surprising fact that it's receiving more and more research attention and also more and more support, that in fact it's not necessary to see the model as a person himself, to see the face, for instance, but that the voice that is commenting what is being done in many cases is enough, unless seeing the body of the person is necessary, of course, to show the model behavior. But if it's more about performing an action where it might be necessary to see the hands but not the face, then that is not necessarily important. The attention guidance principle comes back to the issue that a lot of what we observe in models and modeling examples is transient information, so information that is gone if we don't see it anymore. And also, there's a lot of stuff going on. I mean, if you're watching such a model, if you're watching a model, for instance, if you think of a lot of the examples that you brought, there are many things one could look at. There's the face, there's the hair, there's what the person is doing, there's maybe the clothes, there may be parts of the movements of the hands, of the body, of the feet, and the question is what to pay attention to in order to learn something. And it is important that the attention is being guided here, that we help learners to know what is important and what they should pay attention to. We do this in a different way in observational learning, in modeling examples, because modeling examples, remember, show more or less the full complexity of what is going on, which is one of the main differences also to worked examples. Coming to the end of talking about observational learning, this first area, one thing that can be discussed about observational learning and its effects is that, on the one hand, it is a very strong case that has shown at the time, particularly where behaviorism was strong, that learning from others, learning by observing others, is a very efficient way of not having to do everything by trying it out ourselves. Trial and error behavior can be very cumbersome, very slow, very error prone, and it can be very much faster and much more effective and also less painful, for instance, if we think about observing what a model experiences as a consequence to his or her behavior, and then we decide that it's not a good idea if we imitate this behavior, maybe. But on the other hand, we have this problem that the models are really quite challenging to observe, that there's a lot of things going on, that it's a question, particularly for novice learners, whether they can pay attention to everything that is going on and whether they are able, even with help, even with attention guidance, to pay attention to everything that is going on, and whether they can transfer this into a cognitive representation that they are then able to reproduce, to try, to practice, and where they are able to deduct underlying principles from. Before I'm moving to worked example research, I would like to ask whether you have any questions about the observational learning side. Oh, yes. Okay. Then I'm going to stop broadcasting and I'll ask you guys.
I got a question. First, I'm a big fan. Thank you for the talk so far. I read everything. I was wondering, because you were doing the cognitive modeling of cognitive processes during performance, so when someone is not in a dialogue but does a single performance task, you're doing the cognitive modeling during the act. So I was wondering if you think that's a good idea or a good approach, or do you think that it's possible to make a short explanation after the action to outline the cognitive processes of these actions. Was it clear?
Yes, thank you for the question. I think that if we want to, I mean, the question in the end is when, at which point, and we will discuss this later, are we moving into worked example as compared to modeling examples? But I think if you are showing a behavior where it's very difficult for the person to observe what is necessary to learn the performance, to learn the activity, then it is important that the model would comment on or would externalize thinking processes or maybe things that are very, very difficult to observe, like particular muscle movements. And I do think, and that's the nature of learning from a model, that rather than having sort of instructional explanations or summaries at the end or in between, the model should make explicit what he or she is doing as they are doing it, because it's part of what happens in that moment. At the same time, I think this makes clear what was my point here on this last slide, complexity of behavior. If there are a lot of things going on that are also not observable and that the person needs then to pay attention to as they are trying to imitate the behavior, then it's really quite a great challenge. Let me give you one example. I was once attending a Pilates class, and while the teacher, the instructor, was showing the exercises we were supposed to do, he or she was telling us what she was doing with her muscles, like with muscles that we couldn't see because they were somewhere inside. So it was important for us to be able to imitate the behavior at that moment, but also back home when we were trying to remember how to do the tasks and we couldn't have observed them. But at the same time, it was very challenging. It went very fast, and it was quite hard to listen to her, watch her, what she was doing, and try to think of either try to do it at the same time or then try to remember that as I was trying to imitate the behavior afterwards. Does this answer your question? Otherwise, please just ask.
Sorry, again. Yeah, I totally got what you said, but I think in my case, because I'm talking about my PhD, it's about reasoning. So you do a behavior and then you reason. And I was wondering if you should make the reasoning during the task explicit or afterwards, like the summary of the reasoning during it.
Well, I think if the reasoning normally happens during what you do, then that's how you should do it, because it's really showing how somebody would solve a problem. So if you're solving a problem, if you're doing an activity, and part of performing is that inside your head, you're reasoning, then I think that's what the model should do, because that's part of the modeling. Then that's part of what the students are expected to learn, unless I'm misunderstanding the example that you brought.
Yeah, I think you totally got me, and I think that's perfectly fine. I just already decided the other way around, so I'm trying to defend it, but you're, of course, right.
I was wondering, when you gave the example with a little boy who probably wouldn't imitate a baseball star, how complex could something be that you can learn just from observing? Because just there is a woman in my age doing very complex things. I probably might think just as the little boy who looks at the baseball star and thinking, oh, I think I won't be able to do it. Like, can you actually teach very complex things with observing a model?
Yes, you can teach very complex things by observing a model, but the problem is, at which point is it overwhelming? And one important thing in observational learning is that there have to be some prerequisites there. If you're observing, and maybe that's an example for the kind of situation that you were mentioning, if I have never danced, and then I'm going to like an expert dancing class where people have practiced dancing for 4, 5, 6 years, I may not even be able to decipher what the instructor is showing, let alone imitate it. I would have no chance. So the idea is, of this research, also of Bandura's research, that there are always prerequisites to be able to pay attention to the right things and also to be able to encode and then form a mental representation of what has been going on and to reproduce it. If you're watching somebody do something that is very, very far, many steps ahead as compared to what you're able to do, then it's going to be really hard. The point about the similarity was that, was just that even if I observe somebody who's doing something that maybe has to do with competences that I already have, maybe the little boy is playing baseball, but maybe there are just some moves that are not likely that he or she would be able to show because of height, because simply the adult is taller than the child would be.
Hi, Nicole. I would have a question regarding your model observer similarity. I wonder if the authenticity of the situation is in that design principle, or if you don't consider that at all, because in mathematics we look a lot at the authenticity of tasks. So, for example, a task, let's buy 5 beers for 120, how much do you have to pay, would be a realistic task, but not an authentic task for those children, because they would never go and buy beer. Is this in this model observer similarity? Because it, for me, seems to refer more to the model. And what do you think about this authenticity at all?
Oh, wow, this is a very interesting question. I have actually never thought about authenticity in conjunction with modeling examples. I guess my idea of a modeling example is always that it's authentic because it's not, and it shows something how it is being done. It shows an activity how it is being performed by the model. Whether it's dancing or whether it's arguing or whether it's other things. I mean, many times it's indeed motor activities, but it has also been used in conjunction with, for instance, argumentation. So it is. It may be that the model is behaving didactically in the sense that it is making explicit things that would normally not be explicit. Like Christian was asking me earlier about making reasoning processes overt that would normally just happen in the head. But other than that, the model, the idea, just the fundamental idea is that the model is performing something that he or she would normally do. Does that speak to your question? I think just the idea of coming up with tasks or coming up with worked examples, and maybe then we should look at those and come back to the discussion later, is much more that there's a didactic instructional design where you choose tasks, whereas in modeling behaviors, the idea, or in modeling examples, the idea is that somebody's performing something and I do want to look at this because that's exactly what I want to learn.
So I think your last point, that observational learning is always about something you want to do, is already the answer, because I thought about, imagine you give a child or someone else 2 videos, one video of something the child would want or would be able to achieve, and the other one would be like an out of context example, which would be as hard to do and to learn, but I might guess that the children would rather learn the one they would want to learn and which would be authentic. So I think you already answered the question. Thank you.
But also maybe it has indeed to do with observer model similarity. Like if the observer is observing a model that has no connection to his or her daily life, then I think it will be very hard to learn from this model at all, because there will be no, it will be hard to know what to pay attention to and what to take away from the model, which, as we will see in a moment, in worked example, it's being made much more salient and obvious what is important here. But in the complexity of modeling example, if I have no connection with what's going on there whatsoever, And coming back to Jenny's question, if I'm observing something that is so far away from my performance or from who I am and what I am capable of performing, then I don't think that learning could occur from modeling examples.
So thanks again, and there's another question here.
Hi. My question refers to the adaptation. I actually thought while you were presenting these observation models that if we assume that our model is demonstrating a successful behavior in an understandable way, but we are still not able to follow this example and make it work for us, is there a need for adapting these examples to the special needs that and the special, like, make them address the special problems that one might have, no matter how individual they are in terms of a learning environment, for example?
Yes, I would think so. I mean, if you go away from Bandura and if you move into another direction, another area of research here, for instance, cognitive apprenticeship, here it would become very clear that, I mean, one of the processes in cognitive apprenticeship is also modeling. But cognitive apprenticeship is very explicit about the fact that the teacher or the tutor who's modeling a behavior initially should first provide scaffolds and support and should then gradually fade out the model behavior. The work, the sort of the initial work by Bandura and others really was focused on this aspect of what are the processes. How do we learn in a social situation from observing others? And as I pointed out several times, this has to be seen in the context of behaviorism at the time. But if you look at, like I said, like research on cognitive apprenticeship, or also our research where we're interested in how can we help students or how can we help collaborators in complicated situations to collaborate well, we, similar to cognitive apprenticeship, have soon arrived at the notion that some of our participants needed the entire model collaboration. Others would have only have needed certain particular scenes that they would look at. So I guess one idea would be that you break up the model into different scenes, into different sub-steps that you can then look at. But there's where we're already moving into worked example and where the boundaries between the two research paradigms from my point of view are also starting to blur a little bit. So maybe we can come, can you hold this question and then keep it in mind and come back to it later when we're discussing what are commonalities between and maybe where are the boundaries between worked example learning and model learning? Would that be okay?
Yeah, definitely. Thank you very much for the answer.
Okay, then for now, let's just move ahead a little bit and let's make sure we come back to this. So please move to the next slide. That's the slide on worked examples. So worked examples traditionally include a problem, and I will show you an example in a minute. And then we see the worked out solution steps that lead to the final solution. And the solution, and that's important because it's different from a lot of examples in school textbooks, for instance, the solution is part of the worked examples. It is a very didactic step-by-step process, so it's not showing how a problem was actually solved by somebody, but it's showing how a problem should be solved. It's sort of designed with the instructional goal to teach somebody how to solve a problem. And the idea is that it should focus the learner's attention on possible problem states, the operators that can be applied, and how to apply those operators. And by the way, I say that, you can already guess that a lot of the research in this area has been done in well-structured domains, in particular mathematics, physics, and so on. The presentation here is usually a written account, like you can see if you skip to the next slide, slide 18. Here you see a typical problem. It's a text problem. There are certain givens in the text problem, and the student is asked to solve the problem. And then if you skip to the next slide, you will see the worked example. So here you see step one, something that is being done, step two, something that is being done. So you see how the solution, the steps leading up to the solution are visually also divided up. So it's not just modeling the solving, but it's really working out the solution process in a way that is easily tractable by the learner. If you move to the next slide, please, slide 20. Positive effects of studying worked examples, like in the instance that I just showed, have been shown in many studies, multiple studies. Actually, all the references that I gave you on the right-hand side are not just single studies, but those are all review articles that are reviewing a lot of different studies. Mostly, like I said, the domains for worked examples have been well-structured domains where it is possible to show the solution procedure in a step-by-step fashion, like in the example that I just showed you. So that's one of the prerequisites, that you are in a domain where it is possible to break up the solution process in a fairly clear way. And what has also been become evident from this research is that it is one of the big challenges is for learners to actually elaborate on what's going on there. Because what is not part of the worked example is a rationale for the solution process. So that's something that the student has to do himself or herself, to come up with self-explanations for why something is done in a certain way, to self-explain the solution rationale. This needs to happen from as an activity from the students, and those need support. They don't happen, usually don't happen spontaneously. What is also interesting to note is that particularly in the paper by, in the review paper by McLaren and colleagues, there has been a call to compare worked examples not only to problem solving as the comparison condition, which has been done classically in the classic worked example experiments, but to look at a stronger control condition where the challenges are not so high that a lot of students are going to struggle and fail. So it has been compared, for instance, to structured and supported collaborative problem solving in an ITS, in an intelligent tutoring system. But the results that studying a worked example have still shown that is more effective than even learning or even solving problems with support in an ITS. Please move to slide 21. It has been demonstrated in all those studies that worked examples mostly effective and particularly beneficial for novices, in other words, at the beginning of the learning process, where problem-solving activities have been shown to lead to shallow process strategies like means-ends analysis. Means-ends analysis is if you're trying to solve a problem and you're starting with what you have and you're really trying to reduce step by step, you're trying to reduce where, go from where you are to where you want to be, and you're really trying to search the entire problem space, the entire space of what steps would be possible next every time because you have no clue. This is cognitively very demanding because then you have to take into account and keep in your memory all the possible steps at all times, which is where worked examples are much more practical because they help you to focus on the different problem states, like I already said, and how certain operators can be applied to move you from one state to the other. And therefore, and that's why I mentioned that this, the worked example research traditionally or originally comes from cognitive load theory, it has been shown that studying a worked example can help a lot to reduce cognitive load during initial learning processes and help learners to focus on what is important and to deduct the underlying principles, what is really important to see. Also for worked examples, I have one classic example from the literature. On the next slide, you can see one experiment from the seminal article from Sweller and Cooper, 1985. Here they were looking at algebra problems, ninth grade high school, and those students were learning four different categories of algebra problems, solving for A. And in the acquisition phase, they had two conditions. One was a condition, or a worked example condition, where students would study an example and then solve a problem. So it was always example problem pairs, which is, by the way, one of the typical features of worked example learning, that you always have worked example and problem pairs, and which is also different from observational learning. And then the second condition was a problem-solving condition, where students simply solved problems all the time. And then in the test phase, students in all conditions, in both conditions, solve problems. And the results that Sweller and Cooper found was the worked example students during the acquisition phase, during the learning phase, spent less time. They needed less time to study the examples and then solve their problems than the students in the only problem-solving condition. But then in the test phase, they also still required less time to solve their test problems, so they were more efficient, their procedures apparently worked better, and they made less mathematical errors. Moving to the next slide. The next slide, slide 23, again lists a lot of things, a lot of principles that from this huge amount of research on worked example and on the worked example effect has been concluded. These are all things that need to be taken into account to make learning from worked examples work. And I have divided them up spatially a little bit for good reason. The first two also relate to multimedia research, similar to, if you remember, we had principles for observational learning that related back to multimedia research. So in studying worked examples, it's important to not provide learners with the interface, or not to show the example in a way that splits their attention between text, formulas, pictures, or graphical representations. It's important to present it in a way that makes it easy for the learners to process what is there. And the same is then also true for building on the redundancy effect from multimedia research. You should not present the same information in different ways in the worked examples. So not the very same information should be in a diagram and in the text, but it should be combined, and it should be presented in an as easily as possible processable way. The third point is perhaps one of the most important points when designing worked examples. It should not end up being a modeling example. It should not end up being a full, complete, problem-solving, big chunk kind of thing, but it should be a didactically designed, subdivided procedure where you can clearly see where the steps begin, where a step begins, where a step ends. It should be headings like step one, steps two, like in the example that I showed you. And you should divide those steps following certain sub-goals. If the idea is to exemplify problem states that you need to go through to solve a problem and how operators can be applied to move between problem states, then you also need to make that evident in the way you present, you design the worked example. Then the lower group of points all relate to design aspects of worked examples that take care of the idea that you need to help learners to process what they see, not to fall into an illusion of understanding, because, hey, I'm looking at this example and it's all clear to me. So you need to try to make sure that students process what they see deeply and that they elaborate on what they see. And this is particularly important if we take into account that the main goal, of course, here is to look at that the student learns the underlying principles, makes connection to the underlying principles, and learns more broader schemas from the problems, not just the problem or the worked example that is being presented as an example. That's not the goal of studying a worked example, to learn that one particular example, but to generalize schemata from it. So one is, of course, you can prompt self-explanations. As I already mentioned, an important design feature is to provide example problem pairs. And another alternative is to provide completion problems. In other words, problems where certain steps are missing, that have then to be filled in by the where there are certain blanks in the problem-solving procedure. And as you might guess, this is becoming particularly important not for the first worked example that a student studies, but if you look at subsequent, if you look at studying a set of multiple examples and then the later examples, they should contain blank spots that have to be completed, or another term here would be they should fade certain example steps. So you can start leaving the last step, then the second last step, then the third last step, all the way up, which would be called backwards fading. Another design feature that is somewhat, somewhat not so clear but discussed as an important design feature is that you should also provide, among correct examples, you should also provide erroneous examples, because particularly for little more advanced learners, this can help them to correct, to monitor their own understanding and to elaborate on their own understanding. So it can help in the automation and in the mental model formation at later stages of the learning process. Next slide. Again, the last slide on worked examples, looking at, on the one hand, advantages, but on the other hand, where are limits, where are maybe boundaries that should be discussed. As I mentioned, the one big exam, the one big advantage that is cited for worked examples is that, particularly for novice learners, it helps to decrease cognitive load, it helps to lower cognitive load, but on the other hand, everything, all the learning with worked examples depends on self-explanations, on deep elaborated processing of the example steps. Then on the one hand, as we have heard, it's very effective. It can be very effective for learning, but as the so-called expertise reversal effect shows, you've probably heard of this effect before. It's one of the well-researched effects in multimedia learning and in worked example learning as well. Not at, and what I meant to say here is every, there's an error on the slide, not at every stage of the learning process is it helpful to work with examples. It is very helpful in the initial processes when you're a novice, when it's likely that you're going to end up doing shallow processing or means-ends analysis, so weak solution methods, and where it's likely that you're going to be too overloaded with the problem solving because there are too many things that you would have to keep in mind. But at later stages of the learning process, where you already know something, it is not so useful anymore, unless it's designed, for instance, in a way like with studying erroneous examples or with leaving out steps. Unless it's designed that way, it's useful at the initial stages of learning. And the last point here, as for instance, the example from Sweller and Cooper has shown, worked example learning is also more efficient. It's not only more effective, but it's also more, it needs less time to learn from examples, which also relates to things that I've done, that I've said for observational learning. So if I study a worked example, it's more efficient than having to try out every solution step myself. It's more efficient than learning by doing, than learning by problem solving. But on the other hand, and this also relates to a comment that I saw earlier in the chat, one of the things that I've also been shown in the research is that unless specific care is being taken, for instance, by using multiple example and by encouraging cross-example comparisons and by encouraging the deduction of underlying principles through problem example pairs, unless that is being done, there is often an immediate effect of worked example studying, but you see little transfer of schemas to less or little flexibility in problem solving that is arising from studying worked examples. Any questions right now, particularly to worked example research? Otherwise, I would like to move us to the next slide and to another group activity here. So if you look at slide 25, you can see what I would like you to do. And please ask questions that are relevant beforehand.
Hi, thanks for the really insightful presentation so far. I had a question, and you kind of like touched briefly on this with your slide about multiple examples, but I was curious to know your viewpoint about design fixation as a result of seeing examples. So like from what I've read so far is that students tend to follow the specific process being showed in the work example, and it's kind of like they get fixated by the specific way the example has been solved, and then they try to recreate that specific process, and that has been a problem with worked examples. I was just trying to like get your thoughts on that, like what do you like, multiple examples could be a good way to show them different solutions, but what do you think, like what might be other ways in which that can be avoided?
Nicole, is this one?
Yeah, you are.
Okay. I don't know if I can answer your question. Maybe Nicole is first.
That's fine. Okay. Yeah, you were in line. So if you're in the queue, you get it automatically. You get the floor automatically. Chandan, to come back to your question, that's it's an excellent question. And I think, and you're right about that, I don't think that the research makes this very clear yet. What I could give you as an advice, if you're interested if you're interested in this for your research, is to take a look at the article that I had also put on my literature list by Alexander Rankel. It just came out in Cognitive Science now in this year, because he is relating worked example and observational learning research to a third class of research, to analogical reasoning. And he is also looking at what the three different fields have come up with in terms of how skill acquisition works. And particularly analogical reasoning, I think that I wouldn't agree with Rankel that analogical reasoning is a third paradigm in this area of example-based learning, because I think that indeed analogical reasoning is one of the fundamentals of what underlies learning from examples, because that's exactly what you need here. In order to build a more general schema to learn what you are trying to learn in a more general way that would then allow you to be flexible in applying it to new situations that do not only bear similarity in terms of like structure, but that are maybe very dissimilar in the structure, and to maybe even apply it to new situations. In order to be able to do that, you need a robust schema. You need a schema that allows you not just, like you said, to copy a certain behavior and imitate it and apply it in a verbatim manner to the next problem-solving situation. But that's exactly where the challenge lies in learning from examples. So if you were asking me for what would be my ideas about this, and I think I would like to make a reference here to the literature on learning from multiple representations, because I think the literature on learning from multiple representations, for instance, publications by Sharon Ainsworth, here it has been pointed out very clearly that if we learn with different representations, the most important activity is to support students in making connections between the different representations, because the different representations all showcase or depict or illustrate different aspects of the same concepts. And unfortunately, there isn't all that much literature on how connection making could be supported. There's a lot of literature showing that it's crucial, like in worked example research, showing that you need to make those comparisons. But the little research that is there points at different possibilities of how you could do that, how you could highlight similarities, how you could highlight correspondences between representations automatically, or you could have a student, and now I'm going back to worked examples, for instance, imagine if you have a student having a fully completed worked example on the one side of his paper or on the screen on a computer, and on the other side of the screen you have an incomplete worked example where certain blanks need to be filled in. So what you could do is you could, while the student is trying to complete those, you could highlight what structurally corresponds in the worked out example. Or you could have the student in initial stages highlight what he thinks he wants to do by looking at a catalog of different worked examples and then transferring that to the blank. So I guess what I'm trying to say is you could visually, or yeah, you could try to help a student take over problem solving step by step by having faded or completion worked examples, but not having them fill in those blanks just by themselves, but by making explicit reference to other worked examples. And I think this is what would be supported, this is what would make sense, and my assumption is supported by the research on connection making in multiple representation research.
Oh yeah, thank you very much. That really helps. Quick question, the paper you were referring to by Renkel, is it available online, or I can email you for that paper?
Well, you can email me, I have it, but it, if your university has access, has online access to Cognitive Science, it's in the journal called Cognitive Science. It was in the latest issue, the 2014 issue. It was referenced on the list, so I gave this one article by myself and Tamara van Gogh as a reading, but I also provided a more extensive list of additional readings, and the Renkel paper was among them.
Okay, got it. Thank you very much.
Okay. Hey, Nicole, thanks a lot for your explanations. Your answer of Shannon's question is really what I was thinking about as well. For example, you mentioned on slide 23 something about prompting self-explanation, and I was just wondering if first of all, how this prompting does really look like, for example, in tutor assistance, and if there's a connection to robust learning, for example, to acquire procedural knowledge or conceptual knowledge, because if a pupil is just looking at a worked example, does that mean that he's acquiring procedural knowledge or conceptual knowledge, and what is necessary for the different knowledge types to acquire?
First of all, to the question of how prompting self-explanations would work, if you look at the papers on self-explanations, for instance, I mean, one of the most well-known ones is by Chi and colleagues from 1989, Chi, Bassock, Ryman, and Lewis. It's been done in a very simple way, where you simply tell students, please self-explain. So you basically prompt them. Then in more recent work in computer-supported environments, you can, of course, repeat this prompt. You can sort of program the environment that it would give you a prompt to self-explain every now and then. It could, for instance, record when you're self-explaining and then give you another prompt if you stop saying something for a long time. Another possibility that has been researched also by Chi and colleagues is to put students in a collaborative situation where talking to each other and self-explaining or collaboratively explaining is maybe more natural than if you are self-explaining by thinking aloud. I mean, that's one of the problems, maybe more of how to research whether somebody self-explains successfully. If you do it in an individual learning condition, it's hard to know, right? I mean, you can prompt somebody, you can say, please, while you're looking at the worked example, please ask yourself why a certain step is being performed and try to self-explain what led to this step, or what the step, what the goal of the step was, why it was performed, and so on and so forth. But then if a student does that in their head, it's hard to know. So in a lot of the research, students have been asked to think aloud, which then has been criticized for being unnatural, because that's kind of not what we do when we think, and it may alter our thinking processes altogether, because we do it differently than we would if we did it silently. So I guess when it's easy to prompt for it, apparently, so you don't need to make a big fuss, it's okay if you do it only at the beginning. It's more useful if you can do it in between again, and that's particularly possible in computer-based environments. It's particularly good if you can do it in an adaptive way, like if your system, your computer, your computer-based environment can indicate whether you have not done something in a long time and then prompt you again. And one good way to implement it is to do it in a collaborative fashion, because then talking is more natural, and then you have more access, at least as a researcher, to the thinking processes. I guess that was your first question. Your second question was about procedural versus conceptual knowledge. Well, if you look at the worked examples and the one that I showed you in the earlier slides, what you learn from this in the first place is how to perform a procedure. But if you come back to Shannon's question, the idea, of course, and generally the idea of worked example is that you would learn something that can be transferred to other situations. And one prerequisite for becoming flexible of particular about particular knowledge, one prerequisite would be to develop more abstract, schematic, and more conceptual knowledge. So a goal of the activities that I was discussing in my answer to Chandan's question would be that they help you build more conceptual, more deep understanding, and not just to learn and then imitate a procedure. They also help you to be flexible about the procedure then as a result. But in the first place, they help you to move from building blocks of procedures towards what is behind those procedures, what are the building blocks, what are the underlying principles, and to understand those. And then in turn allows you to again apply the building blocks of the procedures more flexible to future tasks. I hope this was answering your question. One thing that I would like to do, because I see that more and more people are moving, we have until 7, right, Freitas? I would really like us to move to this discussion, and I think we can simply do it in the group on Twitch on slide 25. I would like us to take a look at the Google Doc from the beginning, and try to discuss a little bit about what do you think of your examples are modeling examples, in other words, what are observational learning examples and what are worked examples. And maybe in this discussion try to come back to a lot of things that I said and see whether we've understood them and whether they are, where the boundaries are between the two. So I will stop broadcasting and whoever wants to say, and I will move to the Google Doc, and whoever wants to try to say something about one of the examples, sort them into one of the two hats, or also say something about what makes them, what characterizes them, that please go ahead. Okay, before everybody leaves, then maybe, are you guys looking at the PowerPoint or are you looking at the PDF? If you're looking at the PowerPoint, you could see that there is a slide 26 that is ausgeblendet, that is not visible, but you could make it visible, and you could take a look at examples that I came up with and how I sorted them. And we could maybe for at least a couple of minutes discuss why I sorted them the way, if you agree with the way I sorted them or if you don't. Can you see, can you give me a thumbs up or a smiley if you can see slide 26? Okay, most people can. So, yeah, what do you think? Why? What is a worked example? What is? Why are those worked examples? Or do you agree with the way I sorted them? Where would you maybe disagree? Where do you see commonalities between the two?
So everyone here at LMU agrees with your work example observational learning distinction. Actually, for the first point, the math course book, How to Solve the Equation for Y, I think as long as you state the book, it's definitely a worked out example. If you would cross out the book and just would say a math course, it might also be the teacher teaching how to do this, and that might be observational learning.
Yes, that's true, but then I guess it would also depend on how it's being designed, whether you just sort of see the teacher performing, modeling how to solve at the blackboard and going through the way he or she would solve the task. Or I could also imagine a situation where a teacher solves, or a fellow student solves the problem, and it's being cut into little pieces. And I'm wondering whether that would still be a modeling example or whether it would be a worked example, but maybe one that is not presented in a textual format. I guess for all the Germans, and by now we're only with the Germans, it's a late Friday afternoon. Fridays, did you want to say something about the examples or just something organizational? Otherwise, I can move to my last slide because I see that all the Americans, all the Americans have disappeared, I think, unless I'm mistaken. So let's move. I would have very much liked to spend some time on the discussion of your examples here, but then let's move to sort of the conclusions, and maybe if you want to, you can make that connections between the examples in the Google Doc. In the US it's morning. For us it's afternoon, I know. Or evening, I should say. But let's move to the last slide, which was kind of my conclusion slide for integrating the perspectives. And if you're interested in one view of how to integrate those perspectives, I would recommend reading the cognitive science paper by Renkel, because he's also talking about a way of maybe doing this sort of more formally, what would be a model of how skill acquisition more generally works with on the basis of examples. But if we look at the commonalities between the two paradigms and between more generally learning from examples, well, naturally, both of them put an emphasis on the strengths and on the power of learning from examples, and also on the power that comes from the fact that it's just very effective and efficient, that with not everything in our life we need to try out ourselves, we need to acquire in a slow, error-prone, cumbersome procedure of gradually trying out things and trying out their consequences. Of course, also looking at our evolution, this has a lot of benefits, and there's a discussion in the literature on observational learning in particular, how the fact that we can learn from examples, from observing somebody do something, is also ingrained in our neural system, in the mirror neuron system. So providing examples is something that is efficient and effective. And again, both areas of research make clear, both Bandura and the social cognitive approach and the worked example literature makes clear that this is particularly true at initial phases of the learning processes. And if you remember sort of the four stages of acquisition by Bandura, it became evident that at the later stages, the reproduction becomes important. It becomes important to mentally or physically rehearse the observed behavior and to try it out and to then slowly move from a very erroneous or very incomplete imitation of the behavior to a more complete and more correct imitation or of the behavior, and then to more flexibility of the learned. And the goal always is, for both areas, is that we learn something in a more principled fashion, that we connect the examples to underlying principles, that we acquire more generalized schema from looking at the examples, from observing or studying examples. And again, here you see things that we've been discussing quite a bit in this talk, that it is important in order to be able to connect examples to underlying principles, in order to be able to acquire such more general schemata, it's important that we compare examples to one another, and we've discussed ways of how this could be supported, and that we facilitate learners in connecting examples to those principles, that we allow them to also solve problems, which was one of the points of the example problem pair issues in worked examples. So those are the commonalities, and again, if you want to look at some hypotheses of how the underlying skill acquisition processes are similar or different, I would refer you to the Rankel book. So I'm at the end of my presentation, but I'm happy to discuss more or to answer more questions on your part, and particularly questions that you may have in conjunction with your research projects, with your PhD project.
So I'm just joining the queue. I don't know if there are questions there or you hold them still back. So as far as no one is waving hands and showing up for questions, maybe I could start with the questions I would have for the end. One thing with dropping out, we always have some kind of people losing in the end of the webinar, and to be honest, it doesn't have to be go until 7, so it doesn't have to fill the whole 2 hours of we have here. But maybe Nicole, I would just ask the questions I would have and that I asked every lecturer of the webinars, and those are 2 questions. Maybe you could also answer them connected, so I will just ask them both. So one thing is more connected to the issue that we already discussed about how the learning sciences are defined, and it would be interesting to know from your perspective or from your point of view on the learning sciences, what is the relevance of the principles you showed us today about example-based learning for research in the field of the learning sciences? And the second question that is connected, and it's maybe rather interesting for young researchers or also PhD students, is what would be your advice for young researchers or PhD students who would like to use your paradigm for example-based learning in their research? So from your experience, what would be important issues to be considered then? So it would be great to hear something about that. Thanks.
I think that for the second question, maybe the slides that I showed on the principles and the principles that they are based on a lot of research on what to pay attention to when designing examples or when designing example-based learning might be very useful. And also in the Rankel paper, at the end of the paper, he summarizes sort of principles across the 2 areas of research, so across observational learning research and worked example research, principles that are more general when you design example-based instruction. And I found this list, he has a very sort of understandable way of writing. I found this very useful. So if people want to use worked examples as part of their research, well, one thing that I would recommend is, like I cited also in my talk, there are some really good review articles that cut across a lot of the literature. And then more recently, the one by Tamara and I and the one by Rankel that cut across also paradigms of research on example-based learning. And to read those first and then maybe from those start going into digging deeper and going into some of the original literature. Like for instance, I found it very interesting to read one or two of the many studies of Bandura in the original version, like and try to get the paper from 65 and read it, because it's extremely interesting. Also his book from 86, how a lot of things that he wrote about, if you now read very, very recent work that has been done on with eye tracking, with how people learn from observing other students or other learners' gaze, by Tamara and her group, or Tamara van Gogh and her group, or Halske Harotska and her group at Open University of the Netherlands. A lot of the things are very actually foreshadowed by thoughts that Bandura already had, and I found it quite impressive to read those things from the sort of old times, or also the older articles by Sweller and his colleagues. So I would recommend going with, if you want to go in that area, Renko provides some very useful instructional principles, hands-on. You can use them. I think it's very practical. Then there are like four or five, a bunch of really nice overview review articles that I mentioned in my talk on that one slide that are talking about the many different effects on and research results on worked example learning and also observational learning. And then from there, go into the classics. Try to read some of those because it might be actually really interesting. Also, I think it is recommendable to look a little bit into this new area of research on mirror neurons. Not if it is not relevant, but some of it is relevant as it talks about how the mirror neuron system has to do with how we learn from others and how we learn to understand others and how this is also a basis of observational or social learning. And I find this very interesting. Why is this relevant for the learning sciences? As my last comment, I think here, and it's very unusual, here we have a field of research where a lot of people from very different disciplines have contributed, where we have effects that have been shown in multiple studies, that have been shown repeatedly, that have been called differently, and that was the reason why I made the talk, why I structured the talk, I did structure it, to see that coming from very different backgrounds, very different paradigms, also at very different areas of, no eras, I mean like eras in time of research and learning, like in the 60s or the 50s versus the 1990s and the 2000s for worked example research, they have repeatedly come to the same conclusions and have over and over again shown that learning from examples is a very powerful ability in humans. And I think, therefore, it's very important principle for the learning sciences because it's, like I said, it's very unusual that people coming from domains as different as cognitive psychology, educational psychology, social psychology, but also if you look at the work on cognitive apprenticeship by Collins, Braun and Newman and others, where they're also putting a very high emphasis on modeling and on fading example steps and so on and so forth with very different methodology, not so quantitative, more situated research. This is part of the situated where they have all pointed into the same direction and have shown the power of this kind of learning in humans. And therefore, I consider it to be a very important and very relevant principle. And as a last remark, as I was telling you, in fact, in my dissertation, I was very surprised that the model condition came out best because this was a two-hour video of a very complicated collaboration between a doctor and a psychologist discussing symptoms, developing a diagnosis, coming up with a therapy plan. And even though it was really difficult and they had never collaborated together before and they hadn't had a chance to try out the video conferencing system, across both of my studies that I did, this condition did best. They learned the most, both in terms of how to collaborate well, but also they did best in the performance on their solution. And I, to me, this made it clear very much how this is just a very fundamental and very powerful aspect or principle in human learning.
So Thank you very much, Nicole. And I think we are also, as I see at the watch, we are also running out of time now. So maybe as long as there are no questions anymore, I would propose that we just do a quick bye-bye, saying goodbye around among those of us who are left here. And I would just begin, and maybe in the end, after saying goodbye, Nicole could have a last word, also saying goodbye or something. So from the others who left the session, I think they also credited it as very interesting and insightful, and I think they had not to leave for reasons that were in the webinar, but other reasons, as they might have been interested to hear everything, but as the other webinars, this webinar will be recorded and will be available on the webpage as well, so people can watch it afterwards too. And therefore, I think, Nicole, this was really a great webinar, and from the script I gave to you in the beginning, you made the best model, I think, and this model could, or your webinar could be used as a model for other lecturers to conduct a webinar. So thank you very much. Very interesting, and yeah, would be great to go on with that. So in that manner, we did it today.
Hi, Nicole. Thank you very much from Munich. It was a great overview, and the possibility to ask questions like all the way in between was really great. So no questions were left over at the end. Thank you very much, and have a nice weekend. Bye-bye.
Bye.
I send my regards as well, even though we are just one hallway away from Unicall. We had nice discussions here about examples and about model-based learning, and I have to agree with Freitas. I think that's a very good model of a webinar. Thank you, Nicole.
Well, thanks everybody for the participation and for asking so many questions and really making this an easy job. I mean, we did run out of time at the end, but mostly because you asked questions and there was discussion, and I think that that's the whole idea of such a webinar. And it's, I was actually quite anxious before because I wasn't sure whether it would have been possible that people would discuss and come up with questions, and I had heard from others' webinars that it wasn't so easy, and Fridays had been concerned whether people would say something. And I think it was very lively, and it was a great experience, and it's always fun discussing research, and I hope it was hard, of course, to prepare and make sure that I would be at the right level of expertise.